Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoppe, and this is part two of our discussion of cognitive behavioral therapy with psychologist Dr. Julie Ann Kolzett, who is a psychologist in private practice here in Manhattan. And Julie, can you give out your information for listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your practice? You've got a website, and
yes, it's Dr. Kolzett. That's Dr. spelled out, and my last name, Kolzett, K-O-L-Z, as in zebra, E-T. And my email, I think the simplest email to give out is just my last name, K-O-L-Z-E-T, at gmail.com. Phone number is 646-481-5619, 646-481-5619.
Okay, and, you know, in so doing, you welcome inquiries from our listeners. Great. All right, we're talking in our the first part of our podcast, we're talking about the nature of cognitive behavioral therapy. Let's move on to sort of a subset of what you do with patients, because cognitive behavioral therapy, to some extent, is about getting patients into a more relaxed space. And you have a variety of methods at your disposal. You were trained in biofeedback as well as relaxation techniques. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so you're correct in that cognitive therapy uses a variety of techniques to change mood, thinking, and behavior. So some patients, not all, but like to do the relaxation and the biofeedback that I offer in my practice. And when I say relaxation, it's a pretty general term. So some patients come to me with an idea of what they would like in terms of relaxation. Some patients would like music played while they discuss positive things that they did during the week, on a yoga mat while they're doing it, for example. Other patients like to focus on their breath work. Really learning how to breathe in a way that calms them physiologically, so they're not as inclined to, give their anxious thoughts a lot of credit. So we know that it's harder to have anxious thoughts when we are feeling physiologically relaxed. So
right.
One way we do that is through having patients control their breathing and essentially align their heart rate and their breathing. And patients report feeling a lot of benefits from that.
Can we just circle back to something you just said? Because I think you touched upon one of really the crux of cognitive behavioral therapy, which, although I'm not trained in this field, my understanding is that one of the precepts of cognitive behavioral therapy is that you are not the sum total of your thoughts. And I think that some people identify or connect too much to their thought processes when some ancient practices of meditation tell us that our thoughts are just sort of fleeting projections on a screen, as it were, that are not true reality. They're just our perceptions, and we can sort of take an objective stance, step away from that, and see our thoughts as something that we can sort of let go, like occasional turbulence, or even, to some extent, control.
Right, and exactly. We don't want to give our thoughts too much credit, because oftentimes we have thoughts that are distorted, and that's really the basis of cognitive therapy for depression. It's the belief that patients who experience depression, and that's really where cognitive therapy originated, is in the treatment of depression in, around the 1960s, make predictable errors in their thought process. They either believe too strongly in a thought, as I think you were getting at, and/or they might have catastrophic thoughts where they think the worst about a situation. It has a lot to do with the appraisal of one's environment and making inferences that aren't necessarily reality-based and kind of clinging to those thoughts rather than just seeing the thought for one thought of many one could have when faced with a certain situation.
Well, you know, I must be an amateur cognitive behavioral therapist, which probably is a little bit dangerous, but sometimes when I hear patients tell me about their worries, I say, look, you know, on the fairness doctrine on radio, where I'm, you know, personality, I'm familiar with the rules of radio, is if you have, an announcement about one particular party, you're supposed to balance it with an equal amount of time, you know, equal time, you know, like in a debate, you know, 15 minutes for one side, 15 minutes for another. So I say, look, if you're spending, 4 hours a day thinking about cancer, death, accidents, fiscal calamities, all kinds of horrors, then you should exercise the equal time doctrine in your life, and you should consecrate 4 hours a day to equally unrealistic and extreme thoughts on the positive side, like, I won the lottery, I'm going to marry Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie is going to divorce Brad Pitt, and I'm going to marry Brad Pitt, or whoever your your favorite guy is,
or vice versa.
That's a sort of a sexist way of looking. So, and of course, people kind of laugh, and they say, well, of course, that's ridiculous, but I say, you know, your thoughts are so extreme on the negative side, why don't you just, you know, flip the switch, think of things on an equally outrageous level on a positive side, and they find a great deal of difficulty. They might find difficulty in doing it for 30 seconds, whereas for 4 hours a day, they might be preoccupied with rehearsing a lot of negative possibilities. Or as Mark Twain once said, I've been through some terrible things in my life, and some of them actually happened.
I like that. Yes, and we see the patients who, who struggle with some psychological problems really do tend to think in terms of extremes, and not most often in a negative way, and sometimes in a positive way. So it's important to look at both and to kind of come up with a more neutral, realistic thought. I think some questions that I often, pose to when they have a thought, such as, I have cancer, or he's going to break up with me, et cetera, are, is there an alternative explanation for this situation? What's the cost of believing this thought? How's it going to help me, in other words? And another one would be, what would happen if I changed my thinking? How would that impact my mood? Let's do an experiment. Another one would be kind of taking a more objective view, and what would a friend who was in this situation, mm-hmm. what would I tell
yes.
him or her?
That's actually a very interesting technique, because sometimes I say to patients, often I see patients who themselves are social workers, nurses, and they have a very negative impression of their personal situation. I say, look, you're a helping person. Put yourself in the place of, if you saw a patient and that patient was you, you would treat that patient with a great deal more mercy and kindness and with a far less critical attitude than you're treating yourself. So why don't you exercise your professional skills towards yourself and be objective about your situation? And some people find it hard to do. They're great helpers to others, but they are their own worst enemies.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I tell my patients often, do on to oneself as you would do on to others.
And so, unfortunately, some people, they have to be coached into a more merciful and forgiving attitude towards themselves.
Right, and what's interesting is when we work with, I don't work with animals that often, but when we are interacting with animals, we treat animals, dogs, cats, with this kind of unconditional positive regard.
Yeah, they do goofy things. They crap on the floor. They, pee on the carpet. They tear up the newspaper. And, we gently chide them.
Things, and we love them. And we approach them in a more, loving way. So
yeah.
That's something to think about.
Yes, gentle acceptance and a sense of humor. Okay, certain subsection of your patients, let's face it, this being America 2014, Manhattan, you deal with a lot of patients who have funky body image issues, issues around possibly body dysmorphic disorder. Can you explain what that's about? Both men and women these days, it seems to be really rampant.
Right. To kind of follow up with what we were saying before, I do work with patients on having compassion for themselves, whether they meet the new diagnostic criteria for body dysmorphic disorder, which is now actually classified as a disorder that is more on the compulsive spectrum. I train patients, whether they are a medical weight loss patient, somebody who experiences dissatisfaction with their body, to have compassion for themselves and to be honest and kind to themselves as they examine their beliefs and their thought patterns and assumptions about their body and other people's body. I teach them to expand their idea of beauty, to expand the concept of what is beautiful, and a lot of that can be done in more of this, it can involve breath work and imagery. And
since you're practicing on the Upper West Side of, the Upper East Side of Manhattan, Upper East Side, it involves a trip to the Metropolitan Museum, because all you have to do is go through the 19th Century Gallery and look at the concept of female beauty. And it was a lot chunkier than we allow ourselves in the 21st century. I mean, clearly,
That's such an excellent point, because, one way that I tell patients to expand their concept of beauty is to view art, observe different cultures, spend time in nature, constantly remind yourself that everyone is beautiful in his or her own way. And yes, male and female patients come to me with body image issues, and it's important to to try to limit as much as possible these messages that we get from society. It's very hard to do, but one does not have to get a subscription to Vogue magazine, for example.
Oh my goodness!
Replace it with Martha. I'm just speaking off the cuff here, obviously, but Martha Stewart Living, to cultivate perhaps the creative side, to learn about different hobbies, which can boost one's self-esteem that doesn't depend on the way they look.
Indeed, you talk about the three me's in relationship to more effective weight management. What's that about?
So I use the three me's with patients to really illustrate the cognitive piece of cognitive behavioral therapy, and I think it's a straightforward and relatable way of explaining cognitive therapy. It also normalizes some of the thoughts that we all have. So the three me's are essentially comprised of the little me, the critical me, and the adult me. And it's called three me's for a reason, in the sense that we all have a little me, a critical me, and an adult me.
That's not a takeoff on the mini me from the movie.
No. And I tell patients, I have a little me, I have a critical me, and I have an adult me. So the little me, the traits are that he or she is irrational, impulsive, very emotional, spontaneous. The critical me is judgmental, scolding, unforgiving, sabotaging. And the adult me is this rational, patient, nurturing, level-headed, healthy, fit, mm-hmm. and goal-oriented part of ourselves. And when I apply it to weight loss, I explain to patients that the critical me is really the one who says losing weight is too difficult, I can't handle deprivation, I strayed already from my diet today, so I might as well have this piece of pizza or fourth piece of pizza, etc. And the critical me is the one who really says, with all your diet experience, you should have known better. Whereas the adult me says, nobody is perfect, it's okay to make mistakes, I'm going to learn from my previous dieting mishaps. So that's kind of how I categorize them, and I explain to patients that I like personally to view them as if they were in a car. And the goal is to keep adult me in the driver's seat and mm-hmm. in my case, the little gals, the little me and the critical me in the back seat.
We're always like fighting and hitting each other like a little brother and sister. Hopefully not causing the adult me to drive off the road in distraction or frustration.
Right. So we want to, and again, this is where the relaxation and the meditation can help. We really want to keep adult me in the driver's seat. Little me and critical me can fight and, you know, try to take over the wheel, but when they do take over the wheel, things don't usually happen the way we had hoped. So oftentimes it helps patients just to know that we're not trying to leave adult me, or excuse me, we're not trying to leave critical me or little me at the gas station. That's actually not that realistic of a goal.
Mm-hmm.
They're a part of us, but we can keep them where they belong, maybe not all the time, but in the back seat.
Is your treatment for anxiety very different from your treatment for depression? Are they two distinct entities and they require a different approach, or are they sort of sometimes blend together?
Well, with anxiety, I often get the patients started with biofeedback, where they learn to control, again, their body's physiological and biological response.
And what is that? It's like a gadget which you attach electrodes to people's hands to measure sweat.
Yes.
And then
I measure heart rate. I measure breath rate. There is music that gives the patient a signal that they are kind of breathing in a way that promotes relaxation.
And some people don't even know what relaxation is, so they need the actual objective imagery of the biofeedback tracing to show them, okay, now you're in a relaxed state, and you know at the other times you were not.
Right, and you know sometimes you'll see these complicated graphs when patients are doing biofeedback, but there are ways to make the process actually relaxing when you have an appealing image and some nice music, such as Mozart, playing and giving you feedback versus just a graph of sorts. Anything can really be biofeedback that that gives you an indicator of what's happening with your body. A scale is biofeedback in some ways, as is a thermometer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, cognitive therapy for anxiety, for example, would differ from depression in that for anxiety, we would really focus on the thoughts that the patient has and try to look at the risk appraisal in particular situations and one's resources for dealing with threat. You know, substance abuse, for example, would focus more on negative beliefs about the self and permission-granting beliefs or thoughts about the substance. And with depression, it would be looking at thoughts or beliefs about failure and predicting negative things based on previous situations that didn't work out for him or her.
Right, and that they tend to, you know, like repetitive scenarios that people tend to fall into.
Right.
Is there a type of patient who is suitable for cognitive behavioral therapy, but another type who's like, forget about it, they're just not self-aware enough, they just don't have the consciousness or ability to latch on to these useful teachings that you provide them? It's, in other words, is this for everyone, or is this a point where you just say, look, you're not a candidate?
That's a good question. I think, you know, CBT is a good fit for a lot of people, and perhaps mostly for people who are verbal, goal-oriented, who...
Insightful?
Yeah, insightful, and perhaps people who are actually seeking more time-limited or symptom-focused strategies, who want to ultimately become their own therapist. That's what mm-hmm. the overarching goal of CBT really is. That's why there is a pretty strong focus on education, on educating patients how to talk back to these unhelpful or irrational thoughts and beliefs. So in that way, people who come who are motivated and are willing to commit to monitor and practice some of the tools that they've learned in therapy outside of therapy sessions, I think are the ones who really see the most rapid, benefit of therapy and the most symptom reduction.
Okay, so what is our intelligent medicine call to action vis-a-vis cognitive behavioral therapy today? Is there a book or resource? We'll mention your website once again. It's Doctor, spelled out, D-O-C-T-O-R, Kolzet, K-O-L-Z-E-T.com. And there you'll find lots of information, also some articles about cognitive behavioral therapy. But is there a book that can introduce people to this paradigm to see if that's something that appeals to them?
I think the American Psychological Association, the website, has a lot of great information on CBT, and that's www.apa.org. One can find a lot of great resources on that website, including books, articles, and journals. And as I mentioned, I am happy to answer questions about my practice and be a resource to the extent that I can to your listeners.
Okay, great. So, Julie, once again, you're located in Manhattan. Your phone number is area code?
It's 646, and this is the new office number. I think I may have mentioned that I recently relocated to East 76 in Madison. The new phone number is 646-481-5619. Again, 646-481-5619.
Well, great. Thank you very much, Dr. Julie Kolzet, for joining us. And I've certainly learned a great deal about a therapy that could be a great benefit to many of the patients that I see. I really like working in a teamwork fashion with well-trained psychologists like yourself who can bring an added perspective to comprehensive therapy for patients suffering from health problems. So thanks for doing the work you do.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.